After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Theater ensemble work, I think, teaches young kids and children that it's not about competition, it's about collaboration. It's really about working together in order to find a result that we can all support, you know? And I think that's why I love improv also too so much, because it just taps into that inner being, that place that we kind of tend to lock away when we get older because of fear of rejection or judgment. Improv gets to open us up if we're open, right, to it.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Metta Hour podcast with Sharon Salzberg. I'm Lily Cushman. I produce this wonderful podcast. Today we have episode 219, and we're continuing on with the Real Life series in celebration of Sharon's new book by the same name. Sharon is speaking today with the wonderful Joelle Leon. Joelle is someone who has made several appearances on the podcast before. Today's interview was actually part of the Living an Authentic Life Summit that happened earlier in 2023 that was part of Sharon's book launch. And this recording took place on day 3 of the summit, which was exploring the theme of expansion, openness, curiosity, connection. So that's the theme for the whole conversation. There's a lot here speaking about community, and the community in particular for marginalized and disenfranchised folks, and the exploration of love in the realm of activism, facing trauma, and a lot of the practices of gratitude and saying yes that Joelle integrates into his daily life. And Joelle shares deeply about his experience of being an artist as a Black man and how joy has become a practice for him in his work, in his life as a father and a creator and a person. So we're delighted to have Joelle back. Let's dive into today's episode, Sharon Salzberg and Joelle Leon.
Hi, and welcome back to the summit. I'm Sharon Salzberg, and I'm so happy to be speaking today with my friend and ever-inspiring voice, Joelle Leon. We'll be hearing Joelle's perspective on today's theme of expansion, those times in our lives when we feel most expansive and how to enhance them. Joelle is a performer, author, and storyteller, born and raised in the Bronx, who writes and tells stories for Black people. He's been featured in the Columbia Journal, BBC News, Sirius XM, Forbes, Insider, Medium, Philadelphia Printworks, Blavity, and the Huffington Post. He has spoken and performed at the Apollo Theater, Joe's Pub, Rockwood Music Hall, Columbia University, NYU, and Webster Hall. He is the author of a book about things I will tell my daughter, and God Wears Durags Too, and a father to Lila and West. So I first found Joelle. We met on Twitter. We didn't really meet, but I found him. and I was just like, everything he wrote, I was retweeting or I was liking, and I thought, who is this guy? I don't know who he is, you know? And to this day, we have not met in person. We've not been in the same room, but I have confidence that will happen.
Yes.
I'm so happy to be talking to you today, Joelle. You've been on my podcast several times, and here's a new form, and I really love you, and we've never even met in person.
I love you so much, Sharon. I do. I'm so, you know, it's like one of those things. I had a really great conversation last night with a friend of mine, Deja Riley. And, you know, so much of the talk was about community. And I'm so, like, utterly grateful and thankful for you inviting me into your community. The love is indeed reciprocal. I think you know that already. Like, I'm in deep gratitude, like, for you, honestly. Like, I talk about you all the time. Like, I'll be bragging sweet. About you. I'll be like, you know Sharon Salzberg? Like, yeah, you know. that's the homie. You know what I'm saying? You're a big deal. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you. I wonder if you could share some with our audience a little bit about the path that's led you to who you are today.
You know, someone was asking me, like, how did you learn this stuff? And I was like, well, you know, I say Tower Brock, I say Sharon Salzberg, I say Sylvia Borstein, I say, you know, like, I think there are folks who have created a pathway for mindfulness for me. And so I think, I don't know, you know, nature, nurture, I think it's a little bit of both, you know, like I thank Linda T, my mom and my father, Charles Lorenzo, for sometimes maybe not giving me the language or the tools, but their experience is grounding me, I think, in a way that's allowed me to be curious. You know, like, I think I've always been really curious about the world and wanting to ask questions. And I think my art has really been the big catalyst for more of that inquiry, right? Of, like, spirit and work and love and those kind of being, I think, like, the North Stars, if you will, for how I try to show up in the work. You know, even now I'm talking, I think, about the first time you and I talked. My dog is eating soil right now, by the way. Can you stop doing that? Get down from there. Don't do that. You know, I remember, like, the sense of, like, urgency I always felt, and I don't feel as urgent anymore. And I think a lot of that is because of the practice, you know, and art being part of that practice. And the constant reminder of, like, being able to come back to whatever self, you know, I'm identifying with at the time, and recognizing, like, how impermanent all that is, right? And, like, even the art is just, like, it's I'm just a vessel. And I think the more I've continued to do the work, the more I realize that, like, oh, it's, whether it's the music, whether it's the poetry, whether it's, like, the conversations, it's really the vessel for bridging the gaps for community, you know? But, like, a lot of it was just, like, it's you being part of the practice and helping that practice, and me listening and reading. And just really being curious about that. Like, I don't know this and I want to know more, and trying to continue to do that as I journey, you know? I mean, there's a lot more to that. You know, a lot of this stuff. But, like, I think if I had to give, like, the overarching story, that would be that. Mm-hmm.
That's great. So in my newest book that's coming out, called Real Life, I explore how we can begin to live more authentically, moving from places of contraction and isolation to expansion and openness. And one thing I've often read of yours is how our story gets to shift, how it's not a set narrative we have to be pigeonholed into. And what does this look like in your life? And how has it brought you into a more expansive expression of yourself?
That's a beautiful question. I think, you know, people used to call me wishy-washy because, you know, I'd be into something and then, like, I'd change my mind. And not even change my mind. I've been very much go with the flow, kind of, but more about, like, what feels right for my spirit. You know, like, I think about the seasonality of art a lot. And so there are seasons where I am more of a poet than I am, like, a rapper. Or there are more seasons, at least in the past, where I was more of, like, a thespian than I was, like, an essayist. You know, they would alternate. Sometimes those things would all share space together simultaneously, depending on what my capacity was. But, like, I've just paid attention to the shift. Like, we're all pivoting. And I think the more rigid, I think the more I realized, like, the more rigid I got in those stances of, like, oh, well, I have to do it this way and it has to be this way and I have to make art in this way, the less productive the art was, the less intentional it was, and the less magical it was, you know? And so I think for me, you know, it's if I'm being curious and I'm paying attention, right, then I can look at nature as like a guiding, as a guiding principle too, right? Like the seasons exist for a reason. And so I think I've trusted that in my art practice, and that art practice, which is essentially like my life practice, right? Like they I don't believe really in like compartmentalizing those things. Like they all kind of live in tandem with each other. They feed each other, you know? So I think for me, the more that I saw that the real harmony was in being able to just pay attention to like how those waves went, as opposed to trying to force them to be anything else. The more harmonious I felt, the more peace I felt, you know, like this is the most peaceful I think I've ever felt in my entire life. And part of that is because I'm not striving anymore. There used to be a lot of like, I need to get this thing. And then I would get these things. And then just is always more things, you know? And I think the shifting for me has just been like, oh, okay, I don't have to stay in one place, you know, because nothing stays in one place. And if I'm in harmony with like life and the existence and being in nature, then I get to move mm-hmm. around too. I get to be this thing one day and be another thing. And that's okay, because like that's my truth, you know. It might not be somebody else's truth, but it's mine, you know.
Yeah, that's beautiful. You know, I had this funny memory when you were speaking, because I'm speaking to you from Barre, Massachusetts, yeah. And next door through the forest a little ways is the Insight Meditation Society.
Oh, wow.
And cool. You know, many years ago, Norman Fisher came to visit us, and okay. He was the abbot of the Zen Center in San Francisco, and so it was this hugely prestigious role, and you know, very important in the Buddhist community. And he also was a poet, but you know, almost nobody thought of him that way.
Mm.
And you know, he came and we gave him a tour, and we got into the office, and one of the people working in the office, as we introduced him, said, "Norman Fisher, the poet." And it's like he lit up, and it was like, wow.
That's so cool.
Somebody knows I write poetry.
That's,
you know?
So cool.
I'm not just seen as the abbot, you know, like part of this lineage. And
yeah, yeah.
It was so great. It was such a gift to him. It was like, what a moment.
You know? That's it. It's, so even last night, I was talking to this to this brother after this event I was at, and someone recognized him from a thing that he had acted in. And like you could see his face beam up, because so much of that was like, oh, thank you for seeing me in this other practice, you know? So mm-hmm. often I think, even for me, when I think about this, the story you just shared, I think about how, you know, what I appreciate, and also too, I think I love about you in general, but also I think about our relationship is like how we see each other, you know? And like, not many people know that I make music. I think there are some people who see like the affirmations and don't go further, you know, than that, which is fine. Like, you know, again, capacity, but mm-hmm. there's something to be said for the folks that just take a little bit more time to just dig below the surface. Cause there's like a lot of other things that I get excited about that I'm actually more excited about, you know? So like, I get it. I love that. I love that.
Actually, I can't wait for you to see this book, because there's a little section in there on improv.
Ooh.
And yes, and, you know, so.
I love it. I love, you know, it. I can't, I thought,
wait. Wow. Oh, yeah. It'd be really great. I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah.
You know, so I find that a sense of community is an important way to move beyond contraction,
mm-hmm.
as it reminds us we're not alone, and it offers us a place to ground ourselves and both share and receive love. Like, maybe you can explain yes and in improv to us, and talk a little bit about the role of community in all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think yes and, you know, sometimes we go and yes, you know what I'm saying? It's like it has so many intersections. But like when I think of improv, what I get excited about is the possibilities, you know. And what I also too love about improv, we've been seeing it a lot, I think, more often, you know, when I think about the Upright Citizens Brigade, we think about Freestyle Love Supreme, of course. I think there's these ways that people are trying to bring improv into the workplace, because they're trying to create more collaboration, bigger ideas, things of that nature, you know? And so I think for me, improv is really about how do we create community in ways that opens the door for more expansion, right? Like improv creates an opportunity to expand more in a way that creates community in ways that I don't think we could actually realize existed, you know, because it allows us to dig for a deeper truth, a truth that's not like the instantaneous response to a thing, but how can I show up in this moment, you know, without pretense, without anything keeping us from like the fear or the inhibitions that I think can sometimes keep us from showing up for the work, you know. Improv makes us uncomfortable, you know. I think the best improv folks are the folks who just lean in. And I think for me, I think leaning in has become the biggest way for me to, discover my sense of self. And I think when we're doing improv the right way, that's what we get to do, right? We get to see a person who's sitting across from us who's like pretending to be a fish. You know, and like you just have to, you're going with it. You just go into the moment, you know, you go into the moment, you lean into the moment. And like that can show up in our personal lives, right? The presence, like for me, more so than film, like even in theater, the idea of a theatrical ensemble can be life affirming and life changing because there's an energy that exists when it's like, I am solely reliant on you. You know, like this is not an ego driven platform. Improv and theater is very much contingent on the community working together in tandem in order to create a moment and not necessarily having a defined moment. You know, improv, you can create finality, but it doesn't necessarily exist unless we create that moment together. Mm-hmm. And if we're not doing it together, then the improv kind of sucks. It kind of falls apart. The scene falls apart because you just got to buy into it. And I think so much of that is just being present, you know? But like, I think, If we're looking at And Yes, what And Yes also allows us to do is go, I hear you. I hear what you're saying. And also in addition to, there's something else to be added. It's not a but. It's not me being dismissive of the idea, of the opinion, because also in improv, we keep saying yes to a thing. The rule, like almost the number one rule in the cardinal sin is like, don't say no. You know, you don't say no to a thing because when you say no, you're now closing the opportunity for us to reimagine what the possibilities are. And that's what life is. You know, it's improv is a big experiment. And if we're treating life like improv, that means every moment gets to change. And that's actually pretty cool as opposed to something we need to be scared about, you know?
Yeah, that's tremendous. You know, like as a writer, it's kind of a solitary adventure compared to theater or music making with others. And you know, so it's a fascinating concept. Like, look at that collaboration.
Yeah.
You know, look at how you can block one another. You can have this sort of drama. Like, look at me, everybody. Don't look at them, you know? Like,
yeah. Who are they? Yeah. And it's like, I love that you were asking that, Sharon, because I haven't talked a lot about like ensemble work, but I think more so than even sports where, you know, we're talking very much about a competitive nature that exists that is really honestly required in order to succeed. There's teamwork, but it's also, I have to better an opponent in order to do this. And theater ensemble work, I think, teaches young kids and children that it's not about competition. It's about collaboration. It's really mm-hmm. about working together in order to find a result that we can all support, you know? And I think that's why I love improv also too so much, because it just taps into that inner being, that place that we kind of tend to lock away when we get older because of fear of rejection or judgment. Improv gets to open us up if we're open, right, to it.
So you and I both love to talk about love. So let's talk about love, which is, we are already actually talking about love. That's what we're talking about. But, you know, the way it opens things up for us, for those around us, for all of us. I mean, your daughter did a little improv while we were talking about improv. You know, like,
oh my goodness,
that was yes. So cool. You know,
yeah.
That was
yeah.
really great.
I'm glad you felt that way, Cher. I'm glad that you were feeling.
Of course. I mean, it was so funny because we were talking about improv, and I thought, oh, there's an improv moment.
You know? Absolutely, always. There's,
let's,
you know,
build on that.
let's go with it.
Yes, and
yes, and literally, and. Continuously.
So you're a dad.
I am.
And it's not actually that easy in this world to place a premium on love. You know, it just isn't. So let's talk about it a bit.
Yeah.
You know, I get the question a lot, and I'm interested to hear your response. How does love fit in those situations when someone wants to harm you or someone dismisses you because of the color of your skin or your religion or your gender preference or anything about you?
Yeah, you know, I think compassion plays a big part in that. And I think you are a great person to kind of sit in this space with. I think because even now when I think about compassion, I think about how you reframed it for me in real change, right? And like how it is active, right? This idea of like compassion being an active response to a thing as opposed to being empathetic. And so for me, what I realized is like, if I'm having compassion for self, right? And I'm recognizing my multi-layered experience and the things that I've done wrong and said that may have been inappropriate, right? To people that might have harmed people, whether intentionally or unintentionally, you know? If I can create grace and room and space and compassion for myself in those moments now, where maybe I couldn't have done it before, then I think there's a world in which I can also do that for others while recognizing the context and the environments that have created the people who show up in those ways. You know, and that doesn't mean I get it, I think, right all the time. You know what I'm saying? There are folks that I if I'm being honest, it's really hard for me to show up in compassion for. And so, but part of my practice has been trying to find something that allows me to not like relate to the person, but at least understand why they are the way that they are. And it doesn't mean there's there's not like a deep love I have for this person, but there is an understanding. And I think that understanding can be in gateway as opposed to holding on to any like angst or hate or anger. Granted, also recognizing that I do firmly believe that there is love is rooted in certain kinds of anger, because that kind of anger can create, you know, a Black Panther Party, it can create a SNCC, it can create all these movements that are like, I'm tired of this thing, I feel disenfranchised, I'm marginalized, I'm now going to create a movement that allows my community to exist in a way where we feel seen, we feel supported, we feel loved in spite of, right? I think that there's magic in that. I think also too, if we're clinging to anything in that way, like specifically when I'm thinking about the anger there, I think some of that love gets lost. It gets muddied a little. And so I think when I'm looking at those individuals who, like, as an example, like, you know, there was a prominent person who had reached out to me about doing a podcast, the person who at one point in time was very deep in the throes, I think, of the GOP. And, you know, they have a podcast and they wanted me on the podcast. And I said, I kindly declined. And not because I didn't want to have the conversation, but I didn't want to have the conversation on a platform that was essentially going to create the things that people like go, this person is right or this person is wrong, right? And then we kind of choose sides. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I'm more invested in like the intentional conversations that are going to have impact for changing hearts and minds and spaces that are also safe for that conversation to happen, you know? And so for me, I think some of that is really, it goes back to being intentional about the conversations I want to have about this with the people who I know are also showing up in good faith, because not everyone is showing up in that way. And I think I'm old enough and wise enough to be cognizant of that. And so for, you know, if there are detractors, you know, like it's like I don't get hurt. I get negative comments sometimes, you know, like very rarely, but you know, when they happen, you know, because of negativity bias, right? Like they kind of ring a little louder, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But even with those, like I can recognize the call and need for attention, you know, the need and want for visibility and using somebody else's platform in order to do that, which is why I don't respond to trolls. You know, it doesn't really do the community any service. It doesn't do my spirit especially any service. But it does service the ego. And so when it lives in that space, that's the space I try to kind of remove myself from, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and timing has a lot to do with it, you know? And if you're recently or actively being hurt, you know, it's time to take care of yourself and survive and, you know, maybe take care of the people around you and things like that first and foremost.
Yeah.
And it's when, you know, you can find grounds and a little more security or, or presence, you know, that you might think, wow, this person's really acting out of suffering. Because when I'm reckless, I'm acting out of suffering. So very logically, you know, they are too. And one of the hard things and one of the frustrating things is that, as I said to somebody once, and I was on a stage, actually with Norman Fisher and a bunch of other people in California, and someone asked the question about political leaders and saying, I just, you know, I find it so hard. And I said in response, I understand that, you know, because they seem so self-satisfied sometimes. It's like you can't quite get the pain, you know, but I just know that because I am like my own laboratory. And whenever I am acting wrongly in some way, it is coming from a place of pain. So even if they don't know it, even if they don't feel it, even if they don't express it. And it's also something about the dedication of a life. It's like life's so precious and it's so fleeting, and that's what you're going to do with it, you know?
Yeah, and like you said something like it's, you know, your life, what did you just say? Like, my life is like a laboratory or something like
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
like,
my own life. Yeah, I'm like my own laboratory.
Yeah, I love that because like it that lives direct, like directly correlates what you're just talking to. Like this is, I've been saying this a lot more often as of late, and you know, I say it and I try to remind people, like, I'm not being morbid in that way, but it's like, this is it. Like, at least in this vessel, right? Like in this bodily human form that I'm in. So like, why not just show up in love? And like, why not just take the opportunity to just, I don't know, do the things that we feel called to do the things that we want to do, and do things with love. Like, it feels better. So like, why would I not want to feel better about myself and the world I live in, you know, and just trying to make room for that.
So, you know, the Buddha has the teaching, hatred will never cease by hatred. Hatred will only cease by love. This is an eternal law, he said, which I always found kind of quirky because I considered the Buddha like Mr. Impermanence. And here he is saying, this is an eternal law, which is so similar to something Martin Luther King Jr. said, of course, years later, hatred cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And meanwhile, many of us are taught that love means giving in.
Yeah,
love. Well, you know, strength derives from other qualities like relentlessness or vengeance.
Yeah, like Charles Bronson, you know, like.
That's right.
You know, you think about these so much. It's funny you say that because when you say that, it makes me think of the Charles Bronsons of the world, the Terminators of the world, like all, like so much of what we're taught and shown, especially through media, is like vengeance is the correct way to solve wrong, you know, and because it speaks to like the inner ego, like the human in us, that's like, I, you know, the primate in us, that's like, I want to avenge a thing, you know? And you know, I think you and I have talked about this, and I bring this up often, you know, one of the most loving things that I think about was the Black Panthers free breakfast program, you know? Because it was created out of an urgency, very loving, but very strong, very resilient, and an impactful thing that was done. But we've romanticized love so much that it tends to lose its luster because we've only kept it in this box definition of partnership and romantic liaisons and all these other things, as opposed to how do we love each other from the communal, from the communal space, from. Like, how do I love my colleagues? You know what I'm saying? Like, how do we broaden the spectrum that love gets to sit in? That's the thing that I'm most interested in, that I want to investigate. Like, the other stuff is like there. That's cool. But it's really what you're talking about, you know, that I get excited about.
Yeah, it's tremendous. And the, you know, maybe we don't listen to one another carefully enough, or we have so many assumptions, because I was just reading on the internet. On one of the platforms, some story about somebody who was a hospital chaplain, and somebody was like ranting, you know, through the night, and maybe it was seeming like sort of dangerous and like just freaked out. And instead of, you know, trying to just increase security, or which might be smart in some cases, but the chaplain went up to him and said, what is it you need? What is it you need? And the guy said, it was like so touching. He said, he needed a cheeseburger and some food. He said the food there reminded him of prison, where he'd probably been, and that he'd gone to bed in the hospital 5 nights in a row crying. He was just like so hungry. And the food reminded him of like the worst time in his life. And and so the chaplain went out and got him 2 cheeseburgers and some fries, you know, and and the guy was like, then he was at peace. And, you know, we don't think, when you say the free breakfast movement, I think we don't think let's feed one another and take care of one another. And, you know, those basic, so primal terrors we have of not having enough. And and people don't have enough in many cases. You know, and so working with that and reminding ourselves that nothing is going to, nothing good is going to come of people being hungry. It's just not. And and we can address that instead of like only freaking out at the results of all that.
Because so much of that is driven by fear, you know, and like, and I think not being present, right? Like, Sharon, like when I think about the story you shared, I think about like being able to pause, you know. So, you know, at my day job, like we, there's this thing called like the pause moment that we have for like clients, right? And so it's an opportunity to kind of like look at the creative work and give the client an opportunity to go, okay, what's working? What isn't working? Is this working? You know, we're just getting really curious again. You know, like I think about, you know, my the favorite people I love the most, like you included, are the most curious people, you know, just asking questions about the world. And when we pause, that gives us an opportunity to go, okay, what's actually happening here? Because so much of that is like the trauma response, it's the egoic response, whatever. Because it's like, this is the thing that my body is used to, you know, like even the brother on the other side of that conversation, like they're responding to trauma, and they're in their trauma. And so like, that's what we're getting. And we're seeing the surface, but because we don't, because we think we don't have the capacity, right? We're just kind of, we see it in New York all the time. It's like, you know, you see a person who's struggling with something. It's like, okay, well, I don't have time. You know, I don't have, I'm late for work, or I got to get to the next thing, or I got to do the next thing, you know, and it's this, and it's like, you know, we pause. There's so much we're missing, you know. It goes back to what you were saying about, you know, not listening properly. And I think sometimes we think it's really about the hearing, like with our actual ears. But it's like, if I'm listening with my heart and I'm intentional about this, there's a lot I get to catch, you know, in this world, if I'm just trying to pay more attention and be present for it.
Well, I loved what you said about curiosity, because, you know, I see this kind of a growing interest in research and in just conversation about awe and the feeling of awe, and which I also write about in this book. And I think of it as kind of the cousin of curiosity, because if we don't stop and really kind of like, who are you? Or, you know, where are you coming from? What is this really? You know, I came in here and I was having like a trauma response, or I was having a reaction based on some past thing, you know, or some assumption. And if I don't stop and kind of get underneath it and see what is really going on here, actually, not just my projection, we don't get the chance for that kind of awe. And it was interesting because I was talking to somebody about how my assumption had been that most people think of awe and describe awe. And in fact, quite a bit of the research about awe has been around kind of majestic scenes, you know, like big nature scenes and kind of the overwhelming nature of a far, you know, a redwood forest or something like that. And we feel awe. And in contrast to some people who very purposefully talk about awe, you know, hearing someone's story, like, wow, you know, you came through that, or, or look at that, you know, like, well, look at what you did, you know, like you created that, and it came out of nothing, you know, it came out of brainwaves or something, you know, like, look at that. You know, and the person I was talking to said, actually, they said, there's some research that shows that most people feel the biggest sense of awe not looking at the redwoods, but from one another, from people, if we only stop and pay attention.
Like, I mean, I think our relationship is an example of that, you know? Like, I don't, like, you pausing. I mean, you know, shout out to Lin-Manuel for like being the connector that he is without even necessarily knowing that he was. But the idea of, oh, like what, like who is this person? You know what I'm saying? Like, and you know, you reaching out had such a profound effect on me because what it made me realize was like, oh, this, that the world is so much bigger than we think it is. And like, we're so much more connected than we think we are. And if we're paying attention to that, right? Like there is so much opportunity to be inspired by that, you know, like my awe a lot of the time comes from like, you know, it's like, you know, 6:25, 6:15 in the morning and I'm walking Dilla, like, you know, my bulldog in the morning. And it's like super quiet on the block. It's like, nobody's outside. You know, the sun is kind of slowly starting to rise. So the sky kind of looks like a pink purplish. And it's like, wow, this is really cool. Like this, that I get to be a part of this, you know, that I get to live this life and experience this, you know, like that, you know, I feel like I have some level of awe every morning, you know, or every day. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I was walking Lila, my daughter, my oldest one. I was walking in from school today. And she was just telling me about, we were talking about class participation and she was talking about phonics, you know, and like what she's been learning in English class. And I was in awe of how she was explaining to me, like, the way she's understanding the English language. And you know, it was just kind of blowing my mind to hear my 7-year-old talk about phonics in a way that she wasn't talking about it maybe 3 months ago, which to me means she's paying attention, she's understanding the coursework, and she's learning, she's expanding. And it's just really cool to see that work happen in real time for her, you know, in a way that I think gets overlooked when we're adults. Like, we learn a thing and it's like you're supposed to do it. And it's like, but how amazing is that? That like we can pick up a book, learn something, and then that gets implemented into our daily life. To me, that's awe-inspiring because not everyone can do that. You know, whether it's a learning disability mm-hmm. or some level of like a disability or disorder that bars us from engaging with mm-hmm. the world in that way. And it's the things that we take for granted. You know, like I have a microphone. This microphone was gifted to me, you know, like some time ago from my old job. You know, it's like these things that I didn't know I was going to need later on, but have mm-hmm. now been in service to me. It's like that. This to me is like, oh, yeah. It inspires me to continue to try to be more open to like what else is around us. You know.
Yeah, no, that's so great. Well, even you know the transition of ages in a child. You know that not just the 3 months for your older daughter, but you know moving from infancy to this walking, talking creature, and then. You know, and the things they know and the things they say and the things that change as they go on. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, it's and I get to see the like this chasm between like my 7-year-old and my 3-year-old. And like it blows my mind every time to see how A, they interact and engage with each other, and also to how completely different they are, you know, with regards to how they show up in the world and how they choose to show up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, it's just it's you know, if I'm treating myself like a laboratory and this life like an experiment, right, then I get to practice these things with my children in real time, and they respond or don't respond, you know. And I don't know, it's magical. It's magical because if we're really present for it, we get to see all these different things. You know, there was forget the name of the author. He wrote this book, Here I Am, this fictional book. He also wrote another book that was, his first name is Jonathan. I wish I could remember his last mm-hmm. name, but I've never forgotten. There was a chapter in this book where he's the character, the father character. He's talking about, he says something along the lines of, if I knew that this was going to be the last time that I was going to read my son a bedtime story, I would have cherished it a bit more. You know, and I think about that often because there wasn't like, so like when I would read Lila bedtime stories, I was always cognizant of that because the day came. I remember the day when she was just like, no, I want to read this by myself, you know. And like sometimes she might ask me to read a story, but she's past that age now. There's no, you know, she doesn't look for daddy to read her story. And it's like, oh, but I know I appreciated the time. So it doesn't feel as sad, I think. And I could be wrong. I could be making that up. But I think it feels in my spirit. I can imagine what it would have felt like if I hadn't been not prepared for it, but acknowledged the fact that this thing is a thing that will be true And so just being settled in that space as opposed to the space of non-presence, I guess, you know?
Yeah. No, I think you're right. You know, like, because I think that regret, which I hear so much say later in life, you know, towards the end of someone's life, and the things that we regret are not, man, I spent so much time reading my child's story, you know? It was like I was never home. And, you know, to live life fully means to engage in those things and not to be so strategic about everything. Like, it's unimportant enough, or, you know, it's not building my reputation or my career. Or
the things that we can't keep, you know, granted, like, there's nothing we can take with us, right? But I think the things that we cherish more often than not are the memories we create with the people that we love. We lose out when, you know, like, I work a lot. Like, I'm very cognizant of, like, the work I do, but, like, the work that I do, I love. And so part of my work is also trying to implement ways to create more room for, like, things that are non-work. But even my love practice is work, and some people might say, because I'm a Capricorn, so, like, everything is framed around work. But I've also been trying to kind of revolutionize how we talk about work. At least for me, it's like, work gets to be loving. You know, and if more of us showed up in love in the things that we work at and work with, then I think people would actually be a lot happier, considering we spend so much time working. And so I want my work to be loving, you know, across the board. But anyway, it's the idea, though, of, like, I want to make sure I'm making room for the things that matter. Like, this conversation to me is like, I get to talk to you, you know, so it's, you know, like, that to me is cool. You know, like, that's it's part of the work, but it's like loving work. And so I invite that. Like, I have it now. Like, there's, like, you know, no one could ever say, like, I haven't, like, I, like, Sharon is not my homie. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's with this proof, you know, and that to me is more important than, I don't know, like, some thing title that I can get that can be taken away from me at a whim's notice because someone feels
That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. Which brings me to my next topic, which is gratitude. I do feel so grateful for you, truly. You know, and some people feel that if you're doing inner work, it means you aren't going to try to change external conditions. And so gratitude is an interesting example of that, because some people believe it. And, you know, it's pretty prevalent that if you feel grateful, that you're just going to accept crumbs, you know, and that you're going to let people take advantage of you and so on. But research, I'm told, actually shows differently, that if we practice gratitude, it gives us some energy. And then with that energy, like with that juice, we can sustain an effort towards change. Otherwise, life, it could be too hard or it's disappointing all the time. But, you know, it's just a delicate thing to talk about gratitude without fully understanding that it actually gives us strength and energy. And it's not really a band-aid. It's something every day can give us kind of resilience and replenishment.
And, you know, like, when I think about gratitude and a practice of gratitude, I think about something I shared with you earlier about, like, being content. Because what I was worried about too was, oh, I'm not striving anymore. Does that mean, I don't know, I'm going to be lazy or I'm not going to continue to push myself? But in actuality, because I'm so content, I get to say yes to things that are more closely aligned with my value system and who I am as a human, as a creative, as an artist, as a Black man in this world. Like, I just say, I only say yes to the things that excite me. And that is a privilege I am grateful for, but it's also a privilege I've worked for and I've earned, you know, through saying yes to a lot of things I did not want to say yes to, because I knew I was, at those times, I was grateful that people were coming to me for things that were deemed to be opportunities. You know, some of that stuff was unpaid, me performing for what some would consider to be peanuts. For me at that time, it wasn't, because, like, you know, I was struggling, check, trying to feed my first child and figuring the world out. But I think for me, it's just been, it's there's a level of excitement when it comes to being content and having and being grateful and having this gratitude practice, because I get to just show up fully as myself in the spaces, because these are the spaces I've invited in, you know, because I've been open to saying, okay, I only want the things that are going to challenge me, you know. You know, I've been asking for more ease you know, in my life. And that's, I think, sometimes a very strong contradiction, especially if you're a Black or brown person who's grown up in a community where, you know, and like, I think this is for all people, but I think especially when I think about some of my Black and brown folks, that this notion of the capitalism and having Black wealth, which has become a very big conversation for us. And so much of that is steeped in like striving, right? And like this Western idea of having and accumulating and having things, assets, right? And so much of the wealth that I've gained has been through having conversations with you, sharing space with like sharing space like I did with my homegirl Deja last night, you know, like really, but that was an opportunity that came, and it came because of our relationship, a relationship that I'm grateful for. Like us and I having a conversation now is because of the seeds you and I have planted in this relationship together, you know, and that's the thing that I'm grateful for. You know, it's, and so like some of that is also me being cognizant that I'm top of mind for people because of how I show up in the world. Not because I'm giving, like, it's like I'm paying anybody, you know, it's like, it's, we're feeding each other. You know, you were talking about this earlier, and like, how do we get to feed each other? And, you know, there's so many practices that center around like food being a way that we serve each other. Right. And I think because there's a level of gratitude for recognizing when you don't have much, and if all you have is love, that is sustenance, you know, and that's the thing that I find to be most rewarding. And the more that I've leaned into that, if like opportunity is the thing that's important to me or to a person, the more I've leaned into love, the more opportunities have come from that. And I'm grateful for that.
It's, you know, really beautiful. Yeah. I love what you say about, I mean, everything you're saying is just pointing to how extraordinary this existence is. And I've quoted you in my book saying, we put so much pressure on ourselves to make something extraordinary out of this existence of ours, when in reality, our breath, the mere presence of our flesh, our feet touching the ground, and our hands reaching for a forever burning sun is as extraordinary as we need to be. So that's awesome, awe-inspiring.
I'm listening. Really. I'm like, that is actually, because even you reading it, like, I'm like, it did make me, like, you know, I think I remember one podcast you and I were talking, and I was talking to, like, even now I'm looking out the window and, like, you know, the wind is blowing, branches are like kind of moving and swaying, and it's like my eyes are recording all of this, like my brain is interpreting the thing that I'm seeing. That is wild. Like, how does that even happen in less than a millisecond of like this thing that my, like, I'm gathering all this information. Like, how does that not inspire you to go, oh shit, like what else is happening that I'm missing? You know? Like, that's my thing, you know, like, what else am I missing? So like, even after the event last night, Sharon, I was standing outside and I'm just looking at the sky, and it's like, it was like kind of partly cloudy. I'm like, this is wild that I'm getting to do this, you know, like, it is unbelievable. It is unbelievable to me that a Black boy who grew up in the Bronx, whose father didn't have a lot, has the opportunity to kind of like live all the things, everything, Sharon, that I know that he would have wished for. And I just turned 40, you know, so like, God willing, I know there's like a lot more, but like right now it's pretty fucking awesome.
That is so beautiful.
You know?
Too great. Yeah. So unfortunately, our time is coming to an end, but every one of these encounters is like a building block toward actually being together.
It is. I know. It's like the suspense.
Yeah, no, really. It's like, it's so cool. So I'm wondering if ending our time together, you could lead us in some kind of reflection or practice, or share some kind of poetry, whatever you're moved to do.
I pray you are checking the metrics, the vital signs. Open the blinds and remind yourself you are here today. What you say out loud is just a manifestation of blessings. Adjust your posture and adhere to the knowledge and lessons. You ain't gotta wait. You can take a vow right now and proceed with your fate. The road ahead means you are never late. You see, your peace of mind is in between the marginal lines of mediocre and the next great thing, at the nexus of joy, worn on your heart sleeve like a tattooed sling. If the caged bird sings, then you too can make your way to the rapture. And after the fact, the captured moments of solace you may lack are no longer in the distance. Just another row in the arc from the rest, from the tongue to the breast, from your rest to resistance.
No, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sharon.
It's been an incredible delight as always, Joelle. Thank you for joining me today. If you'd like to be continually inspired by more of Joelle's wisdom, as I am, you can find him on Twitter at, I just got this, it's also, AKA stands for also known as, right?
Yes.
I just got that this moment. It's Joelakamag.
Yeah, because MAG used Twitter. To be my rap name.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just this moment, I was enlightened. It was amazing. Or on Instagram, I am Joelle Leon. IAMJOELLEON. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sharon.
Hey, folks. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to learn more about Sharon's work, her virtual offerings, classes, courses, really all things Sharon, you can visit her website at sharonsalzberg.com. This has been the Meta Hour podcast from the Be Here Now Network. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, and may you live with ease.